Hi, my name is Aditi, and you are listening to Solutions for a Better Planet, a podcast presented by EcoActive ESG. In today's episode, we turn our attention to a topic at the very heart of sustainability, wildlife and biodiversity conservation in India. As one of the world's mega diverse nations, India's ecological heritage is invaluable, yet under constant pressure from urbanization, mining, agriculture, and infrastructure expansion. To help us understand these complexities, we are joined by Dr. Yogesh Kumar Dubey, one of India's leading experts in wildlife and biodiversity conservation. With a postgraduate degree in wildlife sciences and a doctorate from FRI Dehradun, Dr. Dubey began his career at the Wildlife Institute of India, studying mining impacts on elephants and developing spatial databases for tiger reserves. Currently a professor at IIFM Bhopal, he has over two decades of experience in teaching and research, while also advising industries on biodiversity-inclusive impact assessments. He chairs the Center of Excellence on Human-Wildlife Conflict Management and has served on key committees under the Ministry of Environment, Forest and Climate Change, and the National Green Tribunal. So Dr. Dubey, we are delighted to have you with us. Welcome to Solutions for a Better Planet. Your classes back at IIFM were incredible, and I'm so happy to introduce you to our listeners today. To start off, since you have been working in this space for such a long time, it would be great to hear from you about, why India is recognized as a biodiversity hotspot. Could you kind of start by sharing why biodiversity is so crucial for India, not only in terms of ecology, but also for our economy, communities, and climate resilience?
Thank you, Aditi. Thanks a lot. India, as we all know, is one of the top 10 mega biodiverse nations. And India's biodiversity is not just a matter of, either wildlife or forest. It's actually the backbone of our economy, food security, cultural identity, and also a very, very important tool that helps us to become climate resilient. So it is an instrument that we use, or we can very, very strongly use, to become climate resilient. Now, ecologically, if you look at our country, we host four global biodiversity hotspots.
The first one being
the Himalayas. The second is Western Ghats. Then we have Indo-Burma. And then we have Sundaland, which is largely the Andaman and Nicobar group of islands. And these four global biodiversity hotspots, they support everything, starting from pollination to soil fertility to freshwater regulation, provisioning of different kinds of ecosystem services to all the resource-dependent communities. Almost 70% of India's population is depending directly or indirectly on the nature, either for the livelihood, especially in the sector of agriculture, fishery, forestry, non-timber forest produce, and even some of the secondary outcomes like ecotourism, which is turning out to be one very strong instrument that the local communities have been involved in, and they've been able to use it to generate additional sources of income for them. Economically, when we look at sectors like agriculture, fisheries, and even the traditional pharmaceutical sector, where we have things like Ayurveda and other conventional forms of medication that are being now truly recognized by the Ministry of Ayush, and also the ecotourism that we've talked about, they're all deeply biodiversity dependent. Traditional varieties of various agricultural crops, especially like rice in the eastern India, millets being revived under the International Year of Millets, show that how biodiversity underpins the resilient food systems. Shift from the conventional cropping systems to millet-based agriculture itself can make India extremely climate resilient. These are less water-dependent crops, and they're more in sync with supporting the huge range of biodiversity that survives in and around our agricultural systems. From the climate perspective, now it is evident that ecosystems like mangroves and Sundarbans, the forests in the Western Ghats, the grasslands in central India, they all act as natural buffers, reducing floods, droughts, minimizing and helping us to reduce the heat stress and the carbon emission, and also acting as one of the biggest sources of sequestering any additional carbon that is being emitted into the atmosphere because of the developmental activities. So biodiversity is essentially India's first line of defense against all kinds of climate shocks. Just a couple of years back, Government of India had initiated a program so specific to the protection and conservation of the mangrove ecosystems. The program is called as MISTI. So MISTI program has been created with the multiple objectives of not only protecting the biological diversity that is being hosted by these mangrove ecological systems, but also to address the most crucial issue of the livelihoods of the resource-dependent communities, especially the fishermen folk community in those areas. And under this, the Government of India has is working hard to restore almost or to add close to 540 square kilometers of mangroves spanning across 11 states and two union territories. So when we look at it in the holistic sense, socially, culturally, biodiversity is inseparable from our lives. And then we have a lot of these forest-dependent communities whom traditionally we call by the name of the Adivasis or the scheduled tribes in the India, and the indigenous knowledge systems that they have, starting from the sacred groves, either in Rajasthan or in Meghalaya or in Odisha, they all contribute towards the conservation of the biological diversity. Then to address this issue in a more organized manner, following the IUCN guidelines, India has a wide range and network of the protected areas across four categories, starting from national parks, wildlife sanctuaries, conservation reserves, community reserves. Today, we have more than 700 such protected areas under the PA coverage of the country. And the IUCN guidelines says that at least 5% of the total geographical area of the country must be under the coverage of the protected areas. India has very proudly surpassed this number. And India's total geographical area under the PA coverage is more than 5% today. And we are constantly striving to bring in new areas under the coverage of the PA network, because protected area network is being seen as one long-term solution for not just the conservation of the biological diversity, but also to improve upon the resilience of the Indian community towards the climate change.
That's great to know about the different programs that the government is bringing about. And I think culturally too, also India, since India has a long tradition of conservation, starting from sacred groves, community forests, and indigenous practices that protect biodiversity while also sustaining livelihoods. So as you mentioned, I mean, yes, conserving biodiversity is one of our strongest defenses. Now, moving on to pressures and challenges of, you know, the intersection between development and conservation. So from your work on mining impacts in Jharkhand to infrastructure projects across India, you must have seen the intersection of development and conservation very, very closely. So what do you see as the biggest pressure which is faced by India's biodiversity today?
Yeah, see, India is a country that is on the path of the development. It's also one of the largest populated country in the world. So obviously there are needs and requirements of the ever-growing population. And this is an area that would continue to remain as a challenge for India for quite some time. And the country will have to balance the act to look at how the development can be done in the manner so that the impacts on the biological diversity and other forms of biodiversity can actually be minimized. So yes, the fact is that our biodiversity is under pressure from multiple and overlapping drivers. And mining, of course, is one of the crucial areas. And it is an engine of growth, not just for India, but it is an engine of growth for many countries. And but at the same time, this kind of development does bring in significant shift in the land use changes. And it is this land use change that is largely not just driven by mining, but also by a lot of infrastructure, the urban expansion, the linear infrastructure projects like the expansion of highways, rail network, transmission lines to ensure that the power reaches out to every nook and corner of the country. To eliminate or to minimize the energy poverty across different sections of the society, especially in the mineral-rich states like Jharkhand, Chattisgarh, Odisha, parts of even West Bengal. Mining, what mining has done is, mining basically causes the fragmentation.
Yes.
The forest and the wildlife corridors get fragmented, which then limits the movement of the wildlife from one area to the other area. So this is one of the primary damages, and the species that get impacted the most are the species that are wide ranging in nature. So species like elephants, species like tigers, which are the species of the landscape, they require large land masses, they require large land parcels. And these projects then often slice through the ecological corridors, and not just the impact that they create on the biodiversity, there are a lot of secondary outcomes also that come out of these projects, like increasing conflict between humans and wildlife, the problems of the genetic isolation, which in long run, of course, will not be able to get enough information in the short run. In the long run, the genetic isolation can actually cause, the process of, can impact the process of the speciation and evolution. And it actually degrades the habitat. As the habitats get degraded, they pave way for a lot of invasive species. And as invasive species start coming and capturing and occupying these spaces, and they start pushing the native species out, this then results into the shortage of food for a lot of dependent and native biodiversity. And these kinds of changes, knowingly or unknowingly, are also associated with the climate change. So it is not just mining in isolation. These activities, they act as precursors to the climate change, which has now become a threat multiplier for the biological diversity in terms of altering of the rainfall patterns, intensifying forest fires, which again poses a lot of threat to the biological diversity, and then pushing, you know, species beyond their adaptive limits. So many a times a lot of dispersal takes place, range extensions take place, species start moving from one part of the forested area to the other part of the forested area, where then they start posing a lot of problem. Like there are some recent examples where the elephants have now come and become resident in the state of Madhya Pradesh. Okay. The last maybe two centuries, we do not have records of elephants in Madhya Pradesh, but now elephants have become, there is a resident population. All this population has moved from some of the mining states. They came to Chhattisgarh first, and from Chhattisgarh, they've slowly now moved into Madhya Pradesh. And so new kind of problem is being created when a mammoth elephant like elephant, you know, extends its ranges and comes to the areas where people perhaps don't know how to deal and how to handle with these species. So there is a new set of problem that is being created. It may be directly or indirectly, but it is largely being attributed to the problem of the habitat fragmentation. Now, to counter this, India has, of course, very proactively implemented the EIA notification, which is the part of the EP Act 1986. And this commitment actually comes from Agenda 21 from the Rio Summit, where one of the principles of Agenda 21 talks about that the nations must have an instrument like EIA, and that must be the basic instrument to be used for all kinds of decision making on the environmental and developmental matters. So India has been able to use this tool as a preventive tool, identifying the ecological and the environmental risk at an early stage. And so this exercise, which is a statutory exercise in our country, at very early stage, it helps avoid the critical habitats in which the development projects are to be planned. And also, one of the key strengths of the EIA is to be able to suggest the mitigation strategies. And there are some wonderful examples, especially with reference to the linear infrastructure project, where for the first time in the Pinch Tiger Reserve, elevated corridor was being recommended. So it's today's country's biggest mitigation strategy being adopted, where a 1.2 kilometer long elevated corridor passes through Pinch Tiger Reserve, and it allows for safe passage for animals under the corridor, whereas the vehicular movement can take place on the corridor with all kinds of sound barriers, intelligent lighting, so that during the night, the light doesn't disrupt, the sound of the vehicle does not disrupt the movement of the animals. In Rajaji National Park also, a big project is being planned where almost close to around 12 kilometer long elevated corridor is being planned, so that the mobility is also not impacted. And at the same time, the movement of animals like elephant is also not being impacted. But there is a need now to move beyond the project-based EIAs and to incorporate landscape-level planning for addressing the climate and the biodiversity risks that are associated with these projects. So there are these concepts that are being experimented in India also. In many areas, they have started moving beyond project level EIAs to what we call as the cumulative impact assessment, where they look at the, use the cluster approach that in one particular area, if a lot of development, especially for the mining areas, where mining is very, very site specific. So instead of looking at the impact assessment of the individual mines, now, the policymakers have started consolidating cumulative impact assessment, that we must cumulatively look at the impact of the past mines and the future mines that are going to come up in the area, and then appropriately and accordingly develop the mitigation plans that are not just project specific, but are at the level of the landscape, so that the larger landscape-based approach is being used, which in long term is then going to help by biodiversity tremendously in terms of being able to provide the disturbance-free habitats for wildlife to move from one area to other area.
Okay. Yeah, that was lovely to know about the, you know, the challenges and the pressures that are faced, and also the mitigation approaches that have been deployed to deal with this. Now, so in terms of intersection of development and conservation, like stretching it a bit, that we also look at a lot of human wildlife conflict, right? And you are you have been a member of you have been the chair of the Center of Excellence on Human Wildlife Conflict Management, and you deal with one of you know, this India's pressing issue on human wildlife conflict. So what do you think are the most effective strategies to reduce these conflicts and promote coexistence in these areas?
That's a wonderful question. And this is also seen as, apart from the developmental projects and developmental actions, with the increasing human population and human settlements intersecting with the wildlife areas, the human-wildlife interaction is the natural outcome.
Right.
It is not that this is something new. The human-wildlife interactions have existed since the time humans have evolved and they have started co-living with the wide variety of biodiversity that surrounds them. But possibly in the earlier times, the human population was so less that the instances of such interaction would have been very, very few, and possibly not enough to raise an alarm or to be noticed. And whenever this would have existed or have occurred also, the scores would have been settled at some level, which neither impacted the human beings and nor impacted the wildlife significantly. But the modern context where with such huge population, these impacts are now visible, and they have actually started to impact both the sides. It is not just that the biodiversity gets impacted. Yes, humans also get impacted by the human-wildlife conflict. And human-wildlife conflict is being seen as one of the biggest threats to the biodiversity conservation. And at the same time, if we have to deal with this problem, we should not just look at it as a conservation issue. It is as much as a conservation issue, as much as it is a developmental and a social justice issue also. So we will have to use a very, very holistic approach while dealing with the human-wildlife conflict. So in the areas, every area is going to pose a different kind of problem, and a different set of solution will have to be evolved for each of these areas where such kind of problems exist. So some of the effective strategies could be that one of them is that we need to secure wildlife corridors. Wherever there's a possibility, the wildlife corridors need to be secured. If there is a need to procure some additional land for conservation, the way we procure land for different kinds of developmental projects, I think we should also look at securing lands, acquiring lands for biodiversity conservation, and secure these wildlife corridors to provide animals the much needed passage, and also ensure that there is enough food and water available in these corridors, so that the animals don't stray out of the corridors and go to the other areas where then they cause either crop depredation, or the predators, they move out of these forested areas in the search of food, where they go and predate upon the livestock. And then, you know, subsequently with the enhanced interaction with the human beings, at times the casualties are the humans also. Second is to tremendously work on the early warning systems, where in some of these areas where We know that the problems are going to exist. Establish some technology-driven or AI-driven early warning systems by which the people can know about the presence of such animals so that those paths or those areas can be temporarily avoided and let animals pass through those areas, and subsequently humans can also use those areas. Third is the timely and transparent compensation mechanism. So India spends huge amount of money every year in paying off compensation. Almost every state has the ex gratia guidelines in terms of the amount of money that they pay for the loss of life or for the injury that is being caused or for the loss of property. And in some of these states like Chhattisgarh, they have special funds being created to ensure that the marginal farmers and other farmers are compensated for the crop loss that happens due to the depredation that is being caused by the elephants. So timely and transparent compensation mechanism can help tremendously. It will also help build the confidence of the people in terms of that if something goes wrong, there is a mechanism that can take care in terms of minimizing their economic losses. And then we also need to work a lot on the crop and livestock protection measures in terms of the biofences, use of non-invasive deterrents and solar-powered electric fences, blinking lights. So there are a range of solutions. Some of them can come from the traditional knowledge also, use of chili lanterns or use of chili lumris, fire smoke. Again, you know, there is no single solution that can be made applicable to all the areas, but every area will have to evolve. And then land use planning to avoid the high risk zone, so that we must be futuristic in the sense that the areas that are being earmarked for biodiversity conservation, we must ensure that we do not expand the human population or expand the development in those areas. As a proactive approach, or rather I should say that using the principle of the precautionary approach. So precaution is or prevention is better than cure, as they say. So some of these areas where we see that 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line, these problems can arise. So this is the right time to look at those areas, and appropriate land use planning needs to be done. Then one of the things is relocation. We should also consider the areas where the human-wildlife conflict has gone beyond proportions. We should identify land parcels or the forested areas that are understocked. And to substantiate this point, just this year only, last month, government of Madhya Pradesh has done a phenomenal exercise that from one of the areas in Madhya Pradesh, the Shajapur and Shujalpur district, which had the problem of blackbucks, a very high population of blackbuck causing crop depredation and economic losses to the farmer. This year, they have very effectively worked out, and close to 800 blackbucks have been relocated. They have been trapped using non-invasive methods, and they have been relocated to some of the understocked wildlife sanctuaries where there is already underabundance of prey base. So to areas like Gandhi Sagar Wildlife Sanctuary, Nora Dehi Wildlife Sanctuary, where naturally the prey-based population is low, in these areas, these animals have been shifted. But one care that needs to be taken is that you shift animals only to those areas where historically those species are known to occur, that those species can actually survive in these areas. So this relocation can act as a very, very important tool by distributing biodiversity also to the understocked areas and help biodiversity regrow in those areas. And at the same time, this also helps in minimizing the human-wildlife conflict in the areas which face this particular problem. Then, you know, other technological interventions like GPS collars, drone-based monitoring, AI-based alert systems that we have already talked about that can help track animal movement, mobile apps can allow for the faster reporting of the presence of the animals. The mobile apps can also help in speeding the process of the compensation also for the local community. Involvement of community can actually be a game changer. That community should not feel that we are not part of this process. So they, as a part of empowering the communities and also utilizing their local knowledge, community participation is the key driver. So use local youth as the wildlife trackers. In some states, they have created these Hathi Mitrdals, what can we call as, you know, friends of elephant or friends of tiger.
Wow. Okay.
So local community is being involved in tracking, in informing, in mitigating. And this also creates some kind of livelihood opportunity for the local people. So when they feel that they're involved in tackling with the problem along with the government, the results are phenomenal. So wherever these kinds of schemes have been implemented successfully in Maharashtra, in Madhya Pradesh, in certain parts of the Chhattisgarh, the results are very, very good. The number of cases of either crop depredation or the number of instances of human mortality, they've all come down significantly. Women can also play a very, very important role when we talk about community. It'll be unfair to say if the women are being left out. So the women's self-help groups can actually be very effectively utilized with a little bit of training in managing these early warning systems. So that is one area where I see a very strong role for the women's to come forward and help, and then do a lot of these community-led awareness programs. Because awareness is one of the key challenges that most of the time people do not know how to deal with the conflict or how best the conflicts can be avoided. So awareness can act as a very, very important instrument. So to summarize this discussion and to conclude, no, all that I would say is the coexistence succeeds when people feel safe, heard, and fairly compensated.
Okay. That was very insightful, Dr. Dubey. I mean, you have wonderfully explained how technology and community participation, you know, strengthens these conflict management efforts. So this would be the final question, that looking ahead, what do you believe will shape the future of wildlife and biodiversity conservation in India? Is it a stronger policy, community-led initiatives, or, you know, corporate responsibility? And where do you see the biggest opportunities for change?
All right. So basically, you know, the future lies in collaboration. The time has come when the entire nation and all stakeholders will have to come together, and they will have to work together for conservation. So policy, of course, is the role of the government, where government will actively keep evolving their policy frameworks to address the issue of wildlife and biodiversity conservation. Communities will play a very, very significant role. The success will largely lie on how effectively we are able to involve the communities. And then, of course, there is a greater role to play by the private sector also. Private sector and public sector undertakings, which largely look at or deal with the process of the industrial and other forms of the development, they will have to come forward. They cannot be on the back foot. They will have to come forward, and being the responsible corporate citizens, they will have to take this responsibility. So this collaborative model between the policymakers, the communities, and the private sector will play the most pivotal role in terms of policy will provide the legal backbone for strengthening the coexistence and conservation of biological diversity. Communities' involvement will ensure legitimacy and long-term stewardship. Wherever communities have come forward for the protection and conservation of the biodiversity, and we have multiple examples and models. You know, we have examples from Rajasthan, where the Bishnoi community, traditionally and culturally, conservation is embedded in their systems.
Yes.
The 29 edicts that have been pronounced by their Guru Jambeshwar, of those 29 edicts, few edicts specifically talk about the conservation, that how one needs to be compassionate about the wildlife and biodiversity. And it is also very nicely embedded in the Indian Constitution also. I mean, the Article 51AG, where it very categorically talks about that it is the fundamental duty of every Indian citizen to protect and conserve the environment of the country, to have the feeling of compassion for all living forms, including wildlife, protect the freshwater systems, the lakes and the reservoirs. So it is also a fundamental duty that is being embedded upon all of us by our constitution. And third is the corporate responsibility and evolving financial mechanisms to scale these solutions through either ESG or through green bonds or through biodiversity credits, assessing risks of all the developmental projects on. So biodiversity risk assessment should be very proactively carried out by all the private sector and public sector undertaking, and the way we work on the climate change co-benefits, we must also work on the biodiversity co-benefits. And that within the conventional finances, how the opportunity for the finances can be created, and every corporate house must have a dedicated biodiversity office along with the environmental offices, where, because environmental offices often get busy tackling the problem of the climate change. So we need to have a dedicated office on the biodiversity, where people who can be either designated as chief biodiversity officer or whatever that they want to call. And these offices must look at the biodiversity in an extremely comprehensive manner. So the collaboration between the policymakers, the communities, and the corporate houses, I see, if they all come and coalesce together, I see a great future for the Indian wildlife and biodiversity. And I see no reason why a country where coexistence and compassion is the underpinning theme of our existence, the wildlife conservation and the biodiversity conservation will surely go a long way in our country.
That's a really powerful vision. And I like the idea of having a separate biodiversity wing under, you know, private sector as part of the corporate responsibility. So, yes, that was a lovely session. That brings us to the end of our episode. You have brilliantly highlighted why biodiversity matters for every aspect of our lives, the real pressures facing India's ecosystems, and the importance of innovative and inclusive solutions. For our listeners, I believe conservation isn't only about forest and species far away. It's about the food we eat, the air we breathe, and the stability of our climate. Protecting biodiversity is, in essence, protecting ourselves. Thank you so much, Dr. Dubey, for sharing your insights and experiences. Thank you for the work that you do. It was lovely speaking to you, and there was so much to learn today. Thank you.
Thank you, Aditi. Thanks a lot.